22. Homelessness. I bade farewell to the Linton Travel Tavern in the only way I knew, by taking my luggage to the car and paying my outstanding balance with a credit card. I was touched that duty manager Susan had taken the trouble to see me off / take my payment. "There's your receipt, Alan," she said. I could see she was keen to chat. 6 months, eh?" I continued, commenting on the duration of my stay in the hotel. "That's almost long enough to gestate a baby." For a few seconds we embraced, or rather our hands did. Finally, with the handshake over, I got into my car, made sure it was in neutral, turned the engine on, found the biting point, checked my mirrors, indicated to pull out, released the handbrake, and drove away. I'd also put my seatbelt on. All in all, it felt good. I was ready to embark on a new chapter in my life, roughly similar to the one before this, but better because my fee was higher. Yes, I'd be back at the BBC, making television programmes and earning north of 200k per annum as a result. But these days were as fleeting as a collection of fast birds. Upsettingly for audiences and Alan Partridge alike, I was never given the chance to make my much-wanted TV shows, because shortly after I had left Chris Feather's office, Chris Feather had died right there in his chair. Yes, within minutes of signing the deal of his life, Chris had breathed his last. I sent a message to his daughter saying, "I hope it's of some comfort to know that the last thing he did before he died was a truly courageous piece of commissioning." I know she received it because I got a red receipt in my email inbox. At this point, you're probably thinking, "Because? What's that got to do with it? How does the death of Chris affect a contract between you and the organisation he worked for?" And you'd be absolutely right to think that. It'd be like arguing the Treaty of Versailles is now null and void because David Lloyd George isn't with us anymore. And believe me, this was an argument I made very forcefully. A fortnight later, I was in TV Centre with my lawyer, who's more au fait with citizens' advice and whether ramblers can traverse your land than TV contracts, and was pathetic, actually. Incandescent with rage. I don't think I've ever screamed at television executives that loud before or since. And what a Weasley collection of pond life they were. Chris's successor, Jessica Boyle, was a sigh in human form. Every utterance accompanied by a shrug or a rolled eye. For a woman in her position, her posture was a disgrace. Boyle is one of the new breed of BBC TV execs for whom television programmes seem to be a genuine inconvenience. She was flanked by Kev Butterworth, a once-friendly BBC lawyer, who might have been a strapping Irishman, but is also one of the few men I know who's beaten by his wife. I think it started from a sex game that went wrong 12 years ago. He once said to me, "If only I could remember the code word," and then began to well up. He's moved to America now, so he won't mind me talking about it, but his wife did used to beat him quite a lot. She's still in the UK, but I'm not naming her. Anyway, I think she's reverted to her Polish maiden name. She's a teacher in Nantwich. According to Jim, she used to beat him with a plastic hosepipe, then whirl it round her head so it made a futuristic noise. It may be that she well used to work for the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. The BBCRW used to manufacture sound in the pre-synthesizer days. It's an open secret that the TARDIS noise was made by a BBC engineer scraping his keys down the fat wires inside a piano. And I'm told the sliding doors on Blake 7 were made by a clothes brush being swept across the back of a leather jacket. The rest were your usual mixture of John Lennon clones and failed CBBC presenters who have ended up in HR. They pretended to make notes as Boyle outlined exactly why she didn't want another chat show from me, but it was all viewing figures and audience appreciation ratings and stats and figures. "Listen, love," I said. "If TV was all about numbers, they'd put a keypad under the screen and turn it into a giant Casio calculator." This cut no dice with anyone in the room. "Alan, sorry," they kept saying, but looking at each other rather than at me. "It's a contract," I said, "a legal document." "The contract, yes," Boyle sighed. "I wouldn't set too much store by that." "Is that right? Well, let's see what the Director General has to say about this." I shouted and stormed out of the room to the end of the corridor. A minute or two later, I found myself back at the meeting room, having forgotten that the corridor is a circle. Too tired to argue or stomp around any more, I collected my satchel and jacket to the sound of embarrassed silence and left. I knew then and there and then that this was the end of my relationship with the BBC. It was sad in a way. And so, before heading to the car park where my assistant and some sandwiches were waiting for me, I strolled back around the corridor one last time. Ever the maverick, I went against the grain, meandering anti-clockwise through the corridors of laughing liberals. Then I bade the building good day and left. People have suggested I bottled out of taking the BBC's breach of contract to the highest court in the land. Others say they have heard whispers there were discrepancies with Chris's page of the contract. Neither is true. I just had enough. I could easily have seen out the contract, made a cool million, and given them half a decade of my life. But I had bigger fish to fry. That day, I left the BBC. The BBC didn't leave me. So the BBC had reneged on my new TV deal, in a way that shredded any remnants of honour or integrity they may have had. I had racked up substantial debt, and cash flow meant that I defaulted on the rental agreement of my London apartment, and I was asked to leave. I was homeless. I'd only just left the Travel Tavern, and even though I could definitely have gone back to a warm welcome, £49 for a room and breakfast was now out of my budget. I had nowhere to turn, and forlornly tramped the streets in my Rover 200. Night was beginning to fall, and with a seriously heavy heart, I was about to drive to the modest bungalow my assistant shared with her racist mother, until I remembered something. A solemn promise, a vow that had been made to me more than 3 decades before. The words had been intoned by my, metaphorical, guardian angel Trevor Lambert. He'd looked into my 7-year-old eyes and made me a rock-solid pledge. You can come and stay. Any time you like. Hello? It was Sheila who answered the door, now a bit mumsy like Fran had been. There was a raised inflection at the end of her greeting, but these days you don't know if that's because it's a question or because the speaker mistakenly thinks they're cool. Quite reasonably assuming it was the latter, I replied, "Hello?" and kissed her on the cheek. She recoiled a little bit and then tried to shut the door on me. She made a kind of yelping noise, which is when Kenneth appeared. He looked older because he was 35 years older than he used to be. "Alan?" he said. Again, I wasn't sure about the question-slash-cool thing, but this time I said, "Yes, it's me." He smiled a bit and put his hand on her shoulder to reassure her. It could be that she had a poor memory for faces and didn't have access to a television set, I thought. She didn't demur, so by way of explanation, "Alan Partridge." "Aha!" I boomed, and Sheila bolted down the hall. I strode in and dropped my hold-all neatly to one side, before walking into the lounge and warmly greeting them all. They looked astonished, but then it occurred to me. You would be. They'd not seen me since I was about 17. I'd not been in the house since I was 7. Trevor's asthma was now something to behold. He had some of the most severe breathing difficulties I've ever shared a room with. He was rigged up to a breathing apparatus with an oxygen mask strapped over his mouth and nose. The guy was still audible, though, and when reminded who I was, politely asked, "What can we do for you?" I reminded him of his invitation to come back and stay any time. At first, I was embarrassed that he had no memory of it, but then I reasoned that he was old, which explained why it might have slipped his mind. If not for that, awkward! My timing couldn't have been more perfect. A few months earlier, I'd have returned to a pretty empty nest, with just Fran looking after her wheezing husband. But as luck would have it, Sheila and Kenneth had moved back into the family home quite recently because Fran had had a stroke and now needed round-the-clock care. For her part, she seemed a little diffident and didn't say much, but then she was still a long, long way off a full recovery. After a quick cup of tea, I bade them goodnight and bounded up to my room, lying on the bed with my hands behind my head. Lying on my back, I mean, not my front. I was in a state of relaxation, rather than internment. Yep, it felt good to be in the home where I'd been at my happiest, and to be back among the family, although Emma no longer lived there. She was dead. Her space was filled, if you like, by Sheila's husband, Tim, a pretty nice bloke who'd seen my shows and said he quite liked them. Staying there was just the tonic. My 3 months at the Lamberts were just enough to get me back on my feet. I referred to them frequently on Norfolk Nights, and the listeners took their trials and tribulations, Kenneth's continued unemployment, Fran's slurred speech, to their hearts. We each had to make compromises, of course we did. I had to store my property in the garage, even though it was cold in there. For their part, the Lamberts knew if I was going to manage a solid morning of show preparation, I needed the kitchen to myself between 9 and 12. I had to insist on that. For a while, things went smoothly, but soon Trevor's breathing became a bit too loud and was really off-putting. So eventually, I decided to take my notes and dictaphone to the public library and do my work there. In fact, I became such a fixture there, I heard one member of staff quietly refer to me as Karl Marx. I don't think so. I'd take his ideas about the redistribution of wealth and shove them where the sun don't shine. The workers own the means of production, I ask you. I was determined, absolutely adamant, that I wouldn't outstay my welcome at the Lamberts, and so, after 14 weeks, I saddled up and hit the road. "Thanks for having me," I said. "Don't mention it," Fran Lambert seemed to say with the good side of her face. "You can come and stay any time you like."